Okay, we start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, today is December 8th, 2012. Okay, so today we're starting a new chapter of the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Brahmana Bhaga. That is, it's a collection of 10 suttas that are involving Brahmins. And the first sutta in this chapter is called the Brahmayu Sutta. This is a discourse involving a Brahmin named Brahmayu. I see that there are a number of new people here, so if you don't have a copy of the book, The Middle-Length Discourses, if you could be sitting next to a person who has one, then you can share the book. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha has been wandering in the Videhin country. I think that's someplace in the middle of India, with a large community of monks. The Videha country, it's actually a bit towards the east. There's a map on page 76, and you can see Videha and Vajji are close together. They're a bit in the east of India. Okay, so on this occasion, there was a Brahmin named Brahmayu who was living in Mithila. And he's described as somebody who was old, aged, advanced in years, and so on, in his 120th year. So if you think you're having problems at the age of 60 or 70. You could go on for another 50 years. Okay, and he's described as being a master of the three Vedas. The Vedas were the sacred texts of the Brahmins coming down from maybe about 1500 BC, 2000 BC. Especially the Rig Veda was regarded as the most important and mastered all of the different parts of the Vedas. And then it's said that he was fully versed in natural philosophy, which means, I guess, the ability to understand the workings of nature, and in the marks of a great man. This is the important phrase here. The great man is called the Mahapurusa. And there's a special significance in a great man in relation to the Buddha, as we'll see. Okay, so now the Brahmin, Brahmayu, heard this report that the recluse Gotama, who is coming from the Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the Videhin country, and report has been spreading around about this master Gotama the ascetic Gotama, that he is a fully enlightened one, fully accomplished, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, and so on. This is the stock description of the Buddha, that he is one who has understood the nature of the world by himself with direct knowledge, and he explains it to the people. He teaches the Dhamma that's good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and he reveals the spiritual life that is utterly perfect and pure. And so people are saying that it's good to see such arahats, and wherever the Buddha travels, large numbers of people come to see him. But the Brahman Brahmayu is 120 years old, so it's difficult for him to travel a distance to see the Buddha. But he has a younger student whose name is Uttara, who is also a master of the three Vedas. And so Brahmayu tells his student Uttara that somebody has been traveling, this famous teacher has been traveling around in our country, and he is reputed to be fully enlightened. But, you know, the Brahmins don't accept these reports just on trust, on faith, but they want to confirm for themselves that the report is true. And so he wants to send his pupil Uttara to, you know, check out the Buddha, find out whether he really measures up to the reputation that's spreading about him. And so he says, we will find out about this Master Gotama through you. Okay, but now the student Uttara inquires, he says, how shall I find out whether the report about this Master Gotama is true or not? How should I find out whether he's really everything he's built up to be, really a fully enlightened Buddha? Okay, and now the Brahmin, Brahmayu, tells him, this is where the 32 marks come in. He says that in our sacred scriptures, the 32 marks of a great man have been transmitted. And if somebody is endowed with these 32 marks, there are only two possible destinies for him. If he lives, continues to live the household life, then he becomes what is called a Chakravarti Raja. This means a wheel-turning monarch. And he is described as a righteous king who will rule over the world, ruling over the four quarters, the four great continents, according to ancient Indian belief. He'll rule over the four continents, Jambudvipa, that's the continent of India. To the north is Uttarakuru, to the east is Puba Videha, and to the west is anybody remember the Western country? Okay, there's a continent to the west. So he'll rule over those four continents. Puba Paranta. He'll rule over them not by force, not by conquest, but by righteousness. And then it'll have, they're called seven treasures of the wheel, of the wheel-turning monarch. He has, the first is the wheel treasure. This is a kind of mystical wheel that appears to him when he's bound to become a wheel-turning monarch. Then that wheel appears to him. And then he has to earn the right to the throne by practicing righteousness. When he does that, the wheel will stay with him. But if he violates the principles of righteousness, the wheel disappears, and then he will lose his kingdom. Okay, so there's the wheel treasure, the elephant treasure. This is a kind of very powerful, large elephant. Or horse treasure. This is a very swift horse which is actually able to ride through the sky. There is a jewel treasure, very precious jewel, which is a symbol of his rule. The woman treasure, of course, he has to have a very beautiful wife. There is the steward treasure, who takes care of all of his affairs of state for him. The steward treasure is the one who guards all the wealth of the kingdom and knows where to find more wealth, more gold, more jewels. And then there's the counselor treasure, that is like the prime minister who gives him all the necessary advice on policies of state. Then it's said that he has 1,000 sons who are brave and heroic and crush the armies of others, even though the king is supposed to rule by righteousness, not by violence. Okay, but then it's said that he rules without a rod, without a weapon, by means of Dhamma, by means of righteousness. This doesn't mean that he knows all of the Buddha's teaching, but basically he teaches everybody how to observe the 5 precepts, how to observe the 10 ways of good action, to practice generosity, to everybody should relate to everybody else by loving kindness. And so in this way he rules by Dhamma. Okay, that is if the person with the 32 marks, if he decides to live the household life. But if he leaves the household life and goes into homelessness, then he becomes a fully enlightened Buddha. And so Brahmayu is telling his pupil Uttara, in effect, he's saying to him, you should check out this ascetic Gotama. You look at him and see whether he has the 32 marks. If he has those 32 marks, then we can be confident that he's a fully enlightened Buddha. Okay, so now the pupil Uttara accepts the advice of his teacher, and he goes traveling to the country, to the Videhan country. He finds out where the Buddha is. Then he exchanges greetings with the Buddha, has a conversation with him. And then, you know, he starts literally checking him out to look over the body to see whether he has these 32 marks. And it's said that he saw more or less the 32 marks of the great man on the Buddha's body, except for 2. There are 2 marks that were not immediately perceptible. So what are these 2 marks? Okay, one of them is that the male organ is enclosed in a sheath. You know, he can't go to the Buddha and say, Pante, could you please lift up lift up your robe? And then also he had another doubt about, or he couldn't observe the length of the Buddha's tongue. And now the Buddha has the ability to read the minds of others. And so the Buddha knew what the student Uttara was thinking. And he knew that Uttara was uncertain and a bit doubtful about 2 of the marks of the great man. And so now the Buddha is going to help him. And so it's said that now the Blessed One worked such a feat of supernormal power that the Brahmin student Uttara saw that the Blessed One's male organ was enclosed in a sheath. So in this respect, the Buddha helped him affirm 31 marks. And then the Buddha stuck out his tongue full length and used the tongue to cover both nostrils like this. And to touch both ear holes like... Wait, I'm not a Buddha. Okay, so then the Brahmin student Uttara was now certain that the recluse Gotama had the 32 marks of a great man. But still Uttara wanted to check out the Buddha further by observing his behavior. You know, even though it's come, maybe he was thinking, even though it's come down in our texts that one who has these 32 marks becomes either a wheel-turning monarch or a Buddha. But, of course, this is a little bit heretical for Uttara to be thinking this, but maybe he did think, maybe our texts are wrong. You know, maybe they say that 32 marks and he comes down, and if he's a homeless one, he must be a Buddha. But what if he gets confused about things? What if he's sloppy in his behavior? What if when he's answered questions, he can't answer properly? What if he puts his robe down someplace, then he forgets where he put it, then he has to ask one of the monks to find it for him? You know, things like that would show that, you know, even though he's reputed to be a Buddha, but he's a bit off track. Okay, so it's said that Uttara now follows the Blessed One for 7 months like a shadow, never leaving him. Then at the end of the 7 months, following the Buddha in the Vedehin country, he returns to his master in Mithila. And then when he arrives, he pays homage to the Buddha, he pays homage to the Brahmin, Brahmayu, and the Brahmin asks him, his teacher asks him, well, is the report true about Master Gotama? Does he really measure up to the description of him as a fully enlightened one? Then Uttara replies, the report that has been spread about Master Gotama is indeed true, not otherwise, and he possesses the 32 marks of a great man. And now we're going to have the enumeration of the 32 marks. And I have to say that some of these will seem a bit strange. You know, if we read the description, the way that's set down here, I don't want to sound disrespectful, but it will sound a little bit like the Buddha maybe descended from another planet. You know, some of them are not typically characteristic of another human being. But the way I imagine it is that these marks, you know, when we see them at the Buddha statues, sometimes they're very prominent, very pronounced. But I would suspect that they were actually very subtle and that one would have to look very carefully to notice them. And that over time in Buddhist iconography, you know, in statues and paintings, they become more and more exaggerated. So that sometimes you could see even in some of the Thai statues or the Burmese statues, the usma, that's that prominent protuberance on the head, it comes up almost like he's wearing a crown. Okay, so let's go over. And then I should mention that there is a sutta in the Digha Nikaya. It's called the Lakkhana Sutta. This is sutta number 30 in the Digha Nikaya, which describes the significance of these 32 marks, and it explains these 32 marks by way of the behavior of the Buddha in previous lives, in his past existences. And so each of these 32 marks is considered to be a kind of manifestation in physical form of the merits and virtues that the Buddha accumulated by repeatedly exercising certain types of virtuous conduct. And I took notes yesterday on several of these. To go through all of them would take a lot of time, and they get to be to overlap to some extent. It'll be interesting just to note a few of them. And if you want to learn the significance of all of them, then you can read that sutta on your own. Okay, so it said, the first is that the Master Gotama sets his foot down squarely. So this is a mark of a great man that he has. And this is described as a level tread. So most of us, when we put our foot down, usually we put, I think most people put the heel down a little bit first, followed by the sole. Maybe some people put the sole of the foot down, followed by the heel. But the Buddha always walks with a level tread. And this is said to be the result of undertaking in his past lives, undertaking mighty deeds for good purposes and for practicing good conduct of body, speech, and mind. I guess the idea is that good conduct of body, speech, and mind can be described as level conduct or even conduct, balanced conduct. And so for that reason, the Buddha has a level tread when he walks. The second mark is that on the soles of his feet, there are wheels with 1,000 spokes and ribs and hubs, all complete. I think it's 1,000 spokes, not 1,000 hubs, because a wheel will have only one hub. So it's 1,000 spokes, and with the ribs and hub complete. And this is supposed to be the fruit or the result of, in his past lives, it said that he dispelled for many beings, he dispelled fear and terror and provided protection and shelter. Okay, the third mark, he has projecting heels. The fourth, he has long fingers and toes. And the next, his hands and feet are soft and tender. These three marks are said to be the result of abstaining from the destruction of life in previous existences. Okay, the next one is that, this is one that seems a little strange, he has netted hands and feet. It seems that there is some kind of, I don't know, like a net-like structure between the fingers and the toes. And this is supposed to be the result in previous lives of, actually these two, 5 and 6, having soft and tender hands and feet and having netted hands and feet. Those are the result of, in previous lives, practicing the 4 sanghavatu, the 4 means of benefiting others, or the 4 means of establishing wholesome relationships with others. And what are those 4 means? It's practicing giving or generosity, pleasant speech, beneficial conduct to others, and then treating others equally. Treating others the way one treats oneself, or treating others the way you would have others treat yourself. So by practicing these 4 means of benevolence, one acquires soft and tender hands and feet and knitted hands and feet. Okay, then his legs, his feet are arched, and he has legs like an antelope. It's said that his feet are arched because he taught in past lives, he taught people about their welfare, and his legs are like an antelope because, that means very thin legs, I guess, with the probably gracefully shaped legs, because in past lives he taught people different types of arts and crafts. Okay, then when he stands without stooping, the palms of both his hands can touch and rub against his knees. I guess it's somewhat like this. Cheating. Okay, his male organ is enclosed in a sheath. Some of these I didn't take notes on. He is the color of gold. His skin has a golden sheen. This is said to be a result of being patient and without anger in past lives. Okay, then he has very, very fine skin, very, very fine complexion, so that dust and dirt do not stick on his body. So it's said, but in a number of suttas you read that the Buddha speaks about going to the river to bathe. So I don't know how to reconcile those. Okay, his body hairs grow singly. Each body hair, it's in its own hair pore. We'll go through some of these quickly. The tips of his body hairs turn upwards, and the body hairs are bluish-black, curled to the right. He has straight limbs, 7 convexities or protuberances on the hands, the feet, the shoulders, and the chest. He has the torso of a lion. The furrow between his shoulders is filled in. He has the span of a banyan tree, so that the span of his arms equals the height of his body, and the height of the body equals the span of his arms. His neck and his shoulders are even. It's said his taste is supremely acute. Now, I don't know how Uttara would be able to observe this. But I don't have the answer to these questions. He has the jaw like a lion. He has 40 teeth, even teeth. Teeth are without gaps. His teeth are quite white. He has a large tongue. He has a divine voice, like the call of the Karavika bird. He has deep blue eyes. He has the eyelashes of an ox. Again, it's a little it's very puzzling to me, since I've never observed the eyelashes of an ox. He has hair growing in the space between his eyebrows. This is supposed to be kind of tuft of white hair between the eyebrows. We often see this in the Buddha statues. It's illustrated by a kind of dot between the eyebrows. And then it's said here that his head is shaped like a turban, and this accounts for that protuberance on the head. It's a little sort of rise. I would imagine it was just like a very light rise at the top of the head, though in the Buddha's art it gets shown very prominently. Okay, so now Uttara sums up and says, Master Gotama is endowed with these 32 marks of a great man. And now Uttara is going to go further and describe the behavior of the Buddha to show how in all his different types of behavior, he always shows, we call it poise, serenity, self-possession, or a kind of dignity in action, always being mindful, self-possessed, careful, considerate of others, courteous to others. Okay, so he starts by describing his way of walking. I'll just skim over these, because if I read them, it will take a long time. Let's just see if there are any here that are prominent. Okay, so and maybe these can serve actually as a good model for behavior. Not that you should try to imitate a Buddha in all respects, but some of these show, you know, how to act in one's day-to-day life. So the Buddha, when he starts walking, he always puts out the right foot first. And he doesn't put the foot out too far or too close. He walks neither too quickly nor too slowly. And he doesn't knock the knees together when he walks or knock the ankles together. And then when he walks, it's only the lower part of the body that oscillates, but he keeps the upper body straight. And this is interesting. When the Buddha wants to look to the side, he always turns the whole body. And when he wants to look at something behind him, again he turns the whole body around. This is described in the text as the elephant look. You know, when we want to look to the side, we look like this, or sometimes we even turn around to look like this. But the Buddha always maintains this kind of self-possession and dignity. So if there's somebody, say, calling him from the side, then he doesn't look like this, but he'll turn like that. If somebody is calling him from behind, or if he wants to see something behind him, again, he'll just turn the whole body around and look this way. And I said that when he walks, he looks just a plow yoke's length ahead of him. That would be, I guess, about 3 yards, 3 to 5 yards. But beyond that, he's aware of everything that's going on beyond his immediate field of vision. Then when he's approaching a seat, in paragraph 11, when he's turning around to seat his body, he doesn't turn around too far from the seat so that he'll miss the seat, or he doesn't get up so close that he'll sort of be knocking up against the seat, but just the proper distance. And he doesn't lean on the seat with his hand, and he doesn't throw his body onto the seat. You know, the way people, like when they get home after a hard day's work, you just find your favorite armchair, and you just say, wow, what a relief. You just, I do that too sometimes. But as I read this, I learn some new lessons. But you just sit down mindfully. Okay, when he's sitting indoors, he doesn't fidget with his hands or with his feet. He doesn't cross his knees. He doesn't cross the ankles. And then he doesn't shiver and tremble. He doesn't show any signs. He doesn't get nervous when he's indoors. Okay, now this is when he's receiving, when a meal is about to be offered. See, when the monks come into a house to receive a meal, they bring their alms bowl. And the first thing to be done is that the people who are offering the meal will offer the monks, they'll pour water into their bowl so that the monks will then use their hand to wipe the bowl, and then somebody else will come along with, it's like a kind of bucket, and then they pour the water that was used to wash the bowl, they pour that into the bucket. So this is how the Buddha, when he receives the water for the bowl, he does not raise the bowl up too high or keep the bowl too low or tip it forwards or backwards, but he just keeps it at the right height so that the person who's offering the water could offer it easily without any trouble. Then he receives neither too little water nor too much. He'll let the person pour the water into the bowl when it's the right amount. He'll probably put his hand over to show that he has enough. Then you use the hand to wash the bowl, but when the Buddha does this, you know, some of, like, especially newly ordained monks and novices, they like to rub the hand around quickly to make a splashing noise, and then they laugh with one another, ha 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 ha. But then the elder monk will start scolding them, you shouldn't do it that way, that's not proper. But the Buddha, when he's washing the bowl, he doesn't make a splashing noise, and he doesn't turn the bowl around, but he keeps it steady and just, you know, slowly turns his hand around. Okay, and then when he's finishes washing the bowl, then he pours the water at the right distance to the from the bucket that's coming around to receive the water. Okay, similarly now, okay, the washing of the bowl is finished. Now he's receiving first. People, usually they offer the rice first. So in the same way, he receives the rice without putting the bowl up too high, like he's really eager to get the rice, or keeping it too low so that the person has to bend all the ways down to put it in. But he keeps it at the right height. And then he takes exactly the right amount of rice, you know, not too much, not too little. He adds the sauces or the other dishes in the right proportion. Then when he's making, you see, in India, also in Sri Lanka, probably in Bangladesh as well, even today, most people, they eat with the hands, the rice and the curries, with the hands, not with a spoon or with chopsticks, but with the hands. So what you do is you take some of the curry, you know, the prepared dishes, and mix it together with the rice. You roll it into a ball, and then you put the ball in the mouth. And so the Buddha, when he's making, this is called a pinda, a ball of food. So that's why we call the alms food pindapatta. It's the balls of food that are dropped into the alms bowl. So when the Buddha is making the ball of food, he puts the sauces or the other dishes in right proportion to the rice. Okay, and then it said that he turns the mouthful over two or three times and then swallows it. So I've gotten advice from, you know, like health specialists, they always say you should chew many times. So he chews just two or three times in the mouth and then swallows it. But when he swallows, all the rice kernels have been chewed, and no rice kernel remains in his mouth. So he finishes swallowing one ball of food. Only then does he take the next bowl of food. Not like the way many people eat very hastily, you know, without even fully chewing one biteful, already they're lifting up the next biteful. Then he takes his food experiencing the taste, but not experiencing greed for the taste. And then the food that he takes has eight factors. This is actually the reflection that we use, that the monks use when taking the food, that one eats not for the sake of amusement, that's for fun, but for intoxication, to make the body beautiful and attractive, but only for the health and continuation of the body, for ending discomfort, and for supporting the spiritual life. Okay, then when the Buddha has finished eating, then when one finishes eating, then people will come around with more water for washing the bowl. So one will hold out the bowl. Often if there's some food left over, then somebody will come around with a tray, and then one puts the leftover, a little bit of leftover food into the tray, and then that food will be offered to, you know, if people have dogs or cats, to the animals, or just put outside for the animals from the woods to eat it. But one receives, after that, then one receives the water for washing the bowl. And so the Buddha receives the water in the same way, with the bowl not too high, not too low, not bent forwards or backwards, taking not too much water, not too little water, washing the bowl without a splashing sound, and so on. And then washing the bowl, while one washing the bowl, at the same time one is washing the hands. But nowadays people often, they put out next to each monk, there'll be like a little dish with a little piece of soap on it. So one can wash the bowl, then one takes the piece of soap, and because there'll be oil and some grease on the hands, so then one will rub this piece of soap in the hand and then go back into the water of the bowl and rub it again. Okay, so now when the Buddha finishes washing his bowl, then he puts the bowl on the floor, neither too far away from him nor too close to him. And it's said he is neither careless of the bowl. You know, of course, the bowl in those days, they could have been made often out of clay or metal, iron. So if one is careless, if it's a clay bowl, the bowl can break. If it's iron, if you're careless, it could get knocked on the floor and then it gets a dent in it. Nor is he over solicitous about it, so that he shows that, you know, there's a kind of attachment to the bowl. Okay, then when the Buddha finishes eating, he sits in silence for a while. I guess if it's what they call a Sanghika Dana, that's a Dana offered to the Buddha together with a number of monks. The Buddha will wait until the other monks have finished their meal. And even after then, he'll wait a few minutes till people finish putting away the dishes, cleaning up a little, getting things tidy in the kitchen. They'll do the big cleanup after all the function is over. But just wait till everybody finishes, you know, putting away their things. Then people will put mats down on the floor in front of the Buddha, and sort of waiting till all the commotion of people coming in and saying, you sit here, you sit there. When all of that is over and everybody will be sitting sort of silently waiting for the discourse to begin, then the Buddha gives, it's translated here as the blessing, it's called anumodana, but it's not just a blessing like, may you be happy, have long life, may you enjoy good health. Not just a blessing like that, but the Buddha will give a little discourse, not going into like really deep, mind-boggling teachings or really exact teachings on meditation, but just, it's called anumodana because it means literally rejoicing with the good deeds of the people who have offered the meal. So the Buddha will explain, for example, the merits of giving, how observing giving is beneficial both to the giver and the recipients, and then he'll speak about other issues relating to how to live a virtuous life within the household. Then he'll speak about the merits of giving. And then probably at the end, he'll recite some verses expressing the appreciation, his own appreciation, the appreciation of the Sangha. And in those verses, there might be lines like, the good man who gives to the virtuous ascetics with a pure heart, intent on cultivation, such a work or one acquires much merit that leads to happiness in many future lives. What we recite, the typical verse recited today is Bhavatu sabba mangalang rakantu sabba devata sabba buddhanu bhavena sabba dhammanu bhavena sabba sanghanu bhavena sada sauti bhavantu te. Bhavatu sabba mangalang, may there be all good fortune. May the deities protect you by the spiritual power of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. Sabba buddhanu bhavena sada sauti, may you always be safe. Okay, so now when the Buddha is giving the blessing, he doesn't criticize the meal and say, you know, very poor people might be giving. He doesn't say, why are you giving just maybe rice and dal? Why aren't you giving a lot of other fancy dishes? But he's always appreciative, whatever he accepts. And he doesn't do so praising the meal if it's wealthy people giving a lot of sumptuous food. He doesn't say, oh, you gave such wonderful, delicious food. Please, when you invite us again, make sure you give this dish or that dish. But he instructs, urges, rouses, and gladdens the audience with a talk purely on the Dhamma. Okay, so then after giving the anumodana, the blessing talk, then he rises and he departs. Nowadays, at the end of the anumodana, people will, usually they make offerings of other necessities for the Sangha. Typical in Sri Lanka, we get like a package with, usually have a towel, a bar of soap, toothpaste, toothbrush. Sometimes a package of tea, package of milk powder, package of sugar. You know, other things that on special occasions they might have an umbrella, or usually they'll be offering to the eldest monk, they'll get they call it attaparikara, the eight requisites, the three robes, the belt, the filter for filtering water, the razor blade, or it's actually one of those straight razors, a barber's razor, a sewing needle. Okay, so now when the Buddha is walking again, not too slow, not too fast, not like he wants to get away. That's my own fault. Okay, then it describes how he wears his robe, how he goes back to the monastery. Again, this repeats some of the earlier things. When he sits down in the monastery, he establishes mindfulness in front of him. This is interesting, the last one is paragraph. He sits with his mind set on his own welfare, on the welfare of others, on the welfare of both, even on the welfare of the whole world. Okay, now the next paragraph describes how the Buddha teaches the Dharma. This is at the monastery. This will be, it could be like in the evening, early evening, when many people are coming to the monastery to hear the Buddha give a discourse. And so now he's actually doing formal teaching. It's not like just the blessing discourse, the blessing talk after the meal. Okay, so it said that he doesn't flatter the audience and he doesn't berate them or criticize them. You know, it's not like this, they call them fire and brimstone type of preachers. Yep. You are all sinners, you're all going to hell. When you fall into hell, the devils are going to grab you and burn you. Not like that. But he just speaks purely on the Dhamma to instruct, urge, inspire, encourage, and gladden the audience with a talk on the Dhamma. And then there are supposed to be 8 qualities of the speech of the Buddha that are described here. His speech is always distinct, intelligible, melodious. It said he has a melodious voice, audible. It has a ringing tone to it. It's euphonious, I guess a kind of resonant. That seems very similar to melodious. I don't know the distinction, actually. It's deep, a deep voice, and sonorous. And then it said that his voice extends as far as the audience, but it doesn't go out beyond the audience. That's what it says. And I've always wondered, you know, as a practical matter, even when we have like a relatively small class here, for my voice to be heard in the back row, I have to use this electric microphone. In the days when they didn't have electricity, I imagine the Buddha would be speaking to groups of, you know, several hundred people over a large area. I don't know how his voice extended that far. And even if we say that the Buddha might have had the spiritual power to project his voice, but say when ordinary monks were giving discourses, you know, it could be several hundred people come, maybe even 1,000 people. In fact, in some of the descriptions of the famous discourses, it says that 1,000 people came. I wonder if any old Sri Lankan monks are alive from before the days when electricity was introduced into the monasteries. I could ask them about that.
Okay, I noticed last week that listed as your teacher is Venerable Ananda Maitreya.
Yeah.
And I noticed people have called him a bodhisattva.
Yeah.
So would not his voice have carried across? I mean, first of all, let me say I'm feeling a lot of aversion to this sutta.
A lot of what?
If he's a bodhisattva, yeah, for a living day, and this is the capacity of an arahant,
yeah,
mirror, then would not Venerable Ananda Maitreya's voice have carried forever? And does this not point to the non-literal nature of this sutta?
You mean because his voice is preserved in the form of recordings?
I'm wondering, did he ever speak to 1,000 people, and did they hear him? Did Venerable Ananda Maitreya speak to very large audiences without amplification, electrification? So that should have been my first.
I think when I saw him speak in, you know, in public halls, he had the amplifier.
Did anyone ever have difficulty hearing him? Perhaps that's their own karma.
This I don't know, because I didn't go through and ask everybody. But with the with electric amplification, the sound would have carried pretty, you know, throughout the hall. I don't know, it's something. And the fact that somebody is having a bodhisattva aspiration doesn't mean that his voice is going to be amplified over long distances. I mean, the Dalai Lama is regarded as, you know, a very advanced bodhisattva, but when he gives talks in public, it's with amplification.
Yep. I'm guessing with proper architectural design, the voice will magnify. That helped a lot.
Maybe so. But I think, I would imagine that in the Buddha's time in India, they would give the talks outdoors. You know, they would set up a kind of a platform, and probably the Buddha would go up on the platform to talk, but there would not be walls. Maybe sometimes there would be walls. If there's a preaching hall, a lecture hall, then he would preach but talk inside the lecture hall. But often, you know, when it's pleasant weather outside on a full moon night, Anyway, this is a mystery that I haven't been able to solve yet. Okay, so his voice has all of those qualities. Okay, and then when people have, when the Buddha finishes his discourse and people rise from their seat and depart, looking only at him and concerned with nothing else. And there was another quality of the Buddha's discourse that I had read about someplace. And this is that when the Buddha is speaking to even to a large audience, everybody in the audience somehow thinks that the Buddha is speaking directly to him, you know, answering exactly that person's questions, dealing with that person's problems. But the Buddha is speaking, you know, with everybody in mind. So it seems maybe because the Buddha uses his ability to read the minds of others in order to touch on different problems of different people in the audience. Okay, so now the young Brahmin student is sort of summing up his report to his master. He says, "We have seen Master Gotama walking, sir. We have seen him standing. We have seen him entering into the house. We have seen him sitting in silence inside the house. We have seen him eating indoors. We have seen him sitting in silence after the meal. We have seen him giving the blessing or the short talk after the meal. We have seen him going back to the monastery. We have seen him sitting in the monastery. We have seen him teaching the Dhamma to an audience in the monastery." And so that is, he's saying, that's what I've observed of Master Gotama. Okay, so when this was said, then the Brahmin Brahmayu, he must have been listening to this report, you know, very excited, maybe with his hair even standing on end. Because the Brahmins, according to this discourse, they had the record of somebody who's going to become a Buddha, but they had never found anybody who measured up to those to that standard before. And now from this description of the Buddha as one who has the 32 marks and who behaves in such careful, mindful, dignified, self-possessed way, he realizes that somebody has appeared who's fulfilled all of the qualities, all the manifest qualities of a fully enlightened one. So then the Brahmin rearranges his robes in a respectful way, and then he extends his hands in the anjali, that's the joined hands, in salutation towards the Buddha, and he exclaims three times, it's Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. So he recites that three times, and then he says, perhaps, or I think it's better to translate, I hope sometime or other I might meet this Master Gotama and have the opportunity for some conversation with him. Okay, maybe at this point I'll stop and then ask whether we have any questions, anything based on what I've covered so far, you know, the 32 marks or the behavior of Buddha. Okay, there's a mobile microphone. Let's pass that. Okay. We'll take the little ones first.
Little questions. I was reading this and I realized, oh, the Buddha had hair as opposed to Buddhist monks today. So I was wondering how, I guess in the Vinaya, it's specified you don't have hair as a monk.
Yeah.
How did that work? And also, I noticed always in the Buddha statues that the Buddha has very large ears and ear lobes, but that doesn't seem to be one of the
marks. Yeah.
So where did that come from?
Okay. So let's take those two questions. Okay, about the hair, it's the tradition within the Buddhist monasticism and also within even the pre-Buddhist ascetic traditions of India, or at least many of them, that when one leaves the household life, one shaves the hair and the beard, and then one goes forth. And then there's a Vinaya rule that one is supposed to shave the head within, I think it's 2 months or 2 fingers of growth, whichever comes first. So 2 fingers of growth, I think it's like 2 joints of the fingers. But it's traditional, very seldom do we see monks who wait that long to shave the head, because then one starts to lose the distinctive appearance of a monk. It becomes almost like, just, it starts to look almost like an ordinary person with somewhat shorter hair than normal, a little bit like maybe like Barbara, yeah, a little bit like Barbara's hair. So usually in Sri Lanka, say, monks will shave the head, could be every week, usually at most every 2 weeks. In the case of the Buddha, there's a report, it's post-canonical, it's not in the canonical text, but it's said that when the Buddha went forth, he shaved his head, then his hair grew back to a certain length, curling, the way described here, and then it didn't grow any longer, so he didn't have to shave the head in the future, but the hair always remained at that length. Whether this is legend or truth, I don't know. I mean, it's quite possible that the Buddha his hair did grow and that he shaved it, but for some reason he's depicted in statues with the hair like that. And it's described amongst the 32 marks that the hair turns to the right in these little curls. Okay, that's the shaving of the head. The large ears. There's, in addition to the 32 major marks, there appears in time a set of characteristics which are called the 80 minor characteristics. They appear in commentarial texts, not in the sutta texts, and probably the long ears will be found amongst those 80 minor characteristics. I've looked at them in the past, but I didn't. Don't remember them. Okay, those are the two.
My other question is with respect to how literal are we supposed to take this information? Because that's, like you mentioned, it seems a bit weird for a person to have these characteristics. I know that these characteristics predate Buddhism, right? And so I'm curious why Buddha or Buddhism sort of chose to incorporate them into the Buddhist belief. And are we supposed to take these characteristics as something the Buddha really exhibited?
Really?
Exhibited?
Mm.
Like a really long tongue and these sort of things.
First of all, there's a little problem here, which I haven't been able to resolve. Okay, the text, the sutta text, and we find this in a number of suttas, speak about the Brahmins having a record of 32 marks in their sacred books. And yet, I've heard that in the Vedas and the other sacred books, like the Brahmanas, there's nothing about the 32 marks. And so it seems strange that the Buddhist texts would speak about 32 marks, and these texts would be in existence at the same time that Brahmanism was flourishing. And so if somebody from the Brahmin clan comes to learn one of these suttas, which is saying that the Brahmin books speak about 32 marks of a great man, and if he's like a very learned Brahmin, he'll say, wait a minute, we don't have these 32 marks in our books. And then, how to explain that? I don't know. And then, as you said, the 32 marks are rather strange. But my thought would be, suppose the Brahmins did have some record of these 32 marks, then it might be the case that the 32 marks are, as I said early, something very, well, some things one could see are very subtle, but other marks are described so that they're not so subtle, like having arms that come down as long as right to the kneecaps. And those would be pretty long arms, and one would be immediately noticeable with arms that long. Katie?
On one hand, I wonder if you can respond to just what it is like to be a teacher. I mean, here today we have this, a lot of people, I look at the Buddha's teaching as usually very practical, and the Sutta I find is very impractical, as it is.
Yeah, but I didn't quite finish with, I didn't quite finish with my answer to this question. Okay, supposing now that the Brahmins did have a record of these 32 marks, then one could assume that the Buddha might have had the ability to transform his appearance a little bit, or through a kind of psychic determination, mental determination, to make those marks more prominent, so that the Brahmins, when they're checking out the Buddha to see whether he has all of those 32 marks, they will notice those marks, even though non-Brahmins or even Brahmins who are not specialists in the texts wouldn't see them as being, you know, particularly prominent. That's just a hypothesis.
Because it seems to be a typical maneuver of the Buddha to take pre-Buddhist concepts and change them a bit into Buddhist concepts. I think even later in this sutta we see that where the Brahman lists several characteristics and the Buddha kind of redefines them for him.
Exactly. The Buddha... If, in fact, the Buddha displayed these 32 marks for the purpose of winning over the Brahmins, then that would be the explanation. Something I was going to say. Yeah, but anyway, if we take the text on its own word, it's not that the Buddha makes a determination to gain these 32 marks, but they're supposed to be considered marks of physical excellence. And so they arise as a result of the Buddha's virtuous deeds, virtuous behavior in his past lives. So they just, you know, manifest spontaneously. And apparently they're considered, at that time, marks of excellence. Because it's either a Buddha has them, or one who has them is either a Buddha or a wheel-turning monarch. So it's not considered in any way physical deformations. Okay, Katie was going to say something first. Yeah.
Well, I was curious to know how you, as a teacher, a doctor of philosophy, a monk, who's, perhaps you didn't have this feeling when you first read this sutta of this is not going to be maybe the most practical sutta to give to Western audiences. But I'm curious if you had another sutta, how you struggle with that, how you resolve to present something. To me, this is very hard to digest, even knowing that there's some supernatural things that one can experience in jhana or in their whatever the previous supporting conditions might help them experience that. And number two, I guess I was also looking
Let me just think. The reason I took this sutta is really mainly, well, actually, some parts I think are very practical in this. I disagree. Maybe the 32 marks are not so practical, but the descriptions of the Buddha's behavior even though, you know, many of them are sort of beyond our ability to imitate in all respects, but they do set up a kind of model of what I would call good behavior, sort of showing a balance between restraint, consideration for others, showing how to behave with dignity and self-possession in one's day-to-day life, not when having to go someplace, not walking in a hurry, not being a slowpoke, when sitting down, you know, sitting down mindfully at the right distance from the chair, not dropping into the chair, when eating the food, not eating too quickly, not eating too slowly, chewing the food properly, swallowing each bite of food before you start taking the next bite. A lot of that is practical. But it's actually the second part of the sutta that we'll come to next week is the part that I really wanted to emphasize. Because we get a sort of explanation there of what it means to be an enlightened one.
So the second thing I had, you presented the arising of these 32 marks as something that fits with opinion origination by saying his past acts would lead to these traits arising spontaneously. For myself, when I read this, I thought, this reminds me of something that conflicts with dependent origination, that there would be a base nature.
A what?
That there would be a fundamental, permanent nature of 32 marks that would re-emerge, which doesn't fit with dependent origination philosophy. So, but just a few minutes ago you said you explained the way these 32 marks would arise within a dependent origination model.
Yeah.
For myself, when I read this, I thought this looks like something that conflicts with dependent origination because it's saying that there's a permanent, as in not one of the seals of Buddhism, but there's a permanent nature of an enlightened one that will come with 32 characteristics, and those will just reemerge. So to me, it looked like something that was presenting. I agree, there's some very practical things in here, yeah, but it seemed to be very undermined by something impractical. And that it was actually that there were parts of it that were, that could easily be seen as not as being in contradiction to dependent origination.
No, certainly not in contradiction to dependent origination. The fact that, suppose that all enlightened ones have these 32 marks.
Can you see how a person would think that, though, that 32 marks would just be a permanent basis within samsara, that 32 things would constantly exist and reemerge and reemerge?
Well, the 32 marks is just like a model or a diagram, you could say. But it's the 32 marks as they appear. Those are all impermanent because anybody who has the 32 marks is going to pass away. And when that person passes away, the 32 marks that their body possesses will also go pass away. Okay, Barbara had she had her hand up first.
Yeah, I was going to say, we tend to hear this as something that the Buddha taught, and I don't see that in at least this part of the sutta, that this is people's perception.
Actually, that's a good point. That's a good point.
I know that I remember having experience once of seeing Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah.
And when he walked into the hall,
yeah,
he was gold.
Mm.
To me.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean I was looking for it, doesn't mean he was gold. But any of these, it's what people are perceiving. And the other thing that just occurred to me is that, I know these weren't all seen and heard by Ananda, but we've also got whoever put the sutta together.
Actually, that's a good...
And seeing or not seeing these as being important.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very important point. You see, this sutta doesn't take the form at this point of a discourse of the Buddha, but this is sort of reports that are coming down. And it's actually describing a conversation between a Brahmin and an aged Brahmin and his student. This could raise some interesting questions. How did the compilers of the discourses get to know about this conversation between the Brahmin student and his teacher? How to
keep it within the canon?
Well, that's another question, but would seem a little, it would raise my suspicion that how did they get to know about a conversation between the Brahmin student and his teacher? I doubt that Uttara or Brahmayu, when they're meeting the Buddha, would call Ananda up and say, Ananda, this is the conversation that we had, you know, a couple of 7 months earlier. Yeah, 7 months ago, this is our conversation. And then Ananda would get that all by memory. So we could think that this is at least this background to the Buddha's meeting with Brahmayu could be something which is composed. Okay, this gentleman here. Yeah, please.
Yes. I think that each of these marks, each of these 32 marks, might be taken as a physical attribute, that is to say, purely a physical description, or conversely, they might be taken as a description of a behavior. For example, when we say that an athlete, let's say a runner, has eight legs like an antelope, or we're not saying that he's got these peculiar, weird legs.
Yeah, yeah.
We're suggesting that he has the grace of an antelope,
yeah, yeah,
as he runs. And I think many of these marks can be interpreted that way.
Let's see.
Whether that's going a little bit too far with metaphor, I don't know.
I think that certainly works with cases like with a fair number of them. Of course, when it describes the Buddha as having legs like an antelope, that's pretty much what it means. That I think that they're thin legs and kind of gracefully shaped.
Well,
let's just see some of them. When he says that he has the jaw of a lion, again, it means a quite prominent jaw.
My friend and colleague to my left suggests the possibility that the description of the tongue might be a little far-fetched in this sense. But I'm seeing that also as a possible, I want to say metaphor for want of a better word, for the ability to extend one's thoughts, to express oneself in a very profound way. I think there are ways to, I'm not sure, but as I said, I might be pushing this beyond the limit of our studies. There are descriptions that Dogen Zenji also brought forward in terms of tongues being supernaturally involved.
Taking them literally or
no,
metaphorically?
I wouldn't take much of Dogen Zenji's descriptions literally, but I need to say in terms of mountains and valleys. I don't have the quotes or the chapters with me.
The tongue does have a background in traditions preceding Patanjali. So
in what?
In the Vedic tradition preceding Patanjali. So Patanjali comes shortly after the Buddha, maybe 150 years, and the tongue, things like the Vichara Mudra, long tongue, the ability to stimulate a certain spot. But they had a tradition of clipping the end of the...
Yeah.
So there, I don't know much about it, but I know Vichara Mudra has a tradition that probably goes back to the Buddha if we look at it from the conscious point of thinking. How does this thing arise within 100 to 200 years of Buddha? So I don't know much about it, but the tongue has some, the ability to stimulate a spot on the upper of the mouth and then trigger the top of the head, this chakra. There's some way.
Oh, I see, within the yoga tradition.
Yeah, in the pre-physical yoga tradition.
The tongue takes on even, like, becomes even more stressed, even more within the Mahayana sutras. You see sometimes the Buddha sticks out his tongue, and then the tongue is supposed to spread till it covers the whole cosmos. And sometimes when he sticks out his tongue, then six colored rays of light are supposed to come out from the tongue and spread all over the universe. Yeah. But the description here seems to be intending it quite literally.
Yeah.
Because it does say that the Buddha is able to extend his tongue so that it covers the nostrils and reaches to the two ears. Okay, there are some mysteries that we cannot solve. Any further questions or comments? Please, can you take the microphone?
Are there other examples in other texts where the Buddha can change his appearance physically?
There are suttas in which the Buddha does change his appearance in certain ways. In this sutta, he doesn't actually change his appearance. This was just my hypothesis in regard to the 32 marks, that the Buddha might be sort of able to emphasize certain of these characteristics so that the Brahmins will notice them. Yeah, but there's a rather peculiar sutta that occurs in Anguttara Nikaya, Book of the Eights, and also in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the sutta about the Buddha's passing away, where it said that the Buddha describes how he, or explains how he visits different types of living beings, and then it says that he presents himself like them and speaks in their kind of voice, in their kind of language, and he teaches them the Dhamma, and then he leaves. And then when he leaves, then these beings in the different realms could be in the Deva realms, the different Deva realms. They're wondering, who was that? Was he one of us? Or somebody who's coming from elsewhere? But it's not so common for the Buddha to change his appearance. Usually, he maintains the familiar appearance. Any further questions, comments? Okay, then we'll end now. We end with the sharing of the merits. And then we'll have discussion, come back for discussion, say about 10 after 12. So we could examine some of the 32 marks or Buddha's behavior after lunch. Okay, so we now share the merits with the devas or deities, the buddhas, the nagas, wishing, and with all beings in the world, wishing them to be well and happy and for all of their good purposes to be fulfilled. Akasata chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chiran Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chiran Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang Etavata Chaham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Devanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Chaham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Chaham Hehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Satanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Bhavagupadaya Avichihetato Etantare Satakayupapana Rupiya Rupicha Asanya Sanino Dukkha Pamuchantu Pusantu Nibhutin. Okay, we end with three the half bows to the Buddha.
Out of funding.